The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free ARFCOM do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love to stick in battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free ARFCOM starts now.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, fellow ARFCOMers. Radio Free ARFCOM starts right now, and boy, do we have a show set up for you tonight. We are going to start off with our resident NRA board member, Joe DeBurgolace. We'll get to him in just a minute here. Then we're going to have a special guest live from Tel Aviv. He's an intelligence analyst. He's going to talk to us about the situation ongoing with Israel, with Iran, with potential problems with Syria. He's going to talk about the assassination in Dubai of the terrorist there, and it's going to be a really interesting interview. We've got John Ross. He's an author of Unintended Consequences. I'm sure most of you have heard of that book. And then at the end of the show tonight, oh, don't let me forget, we're going to have Matt Hoffman going golf. At the end of the show tonight, we've got Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, the Florida Senate candidate, Florida District 22. He is scheduled to be on at 8:30. Now, his PR person told me that he has an event that he's scheduled to go, and it's supposed to end right before 8:30. So she told me she guaranteed he'd be on, but she said he did have an event to go to right before we got him scheduled on the show. So hopefully everything goes smooth there. I'm sure it will. Anyway, let's get right to it for everybody. If you have any questions during the show you'd like for me to ask any of our guests, feel free to IM me, radio_free_ARFCOM. Just IM me right there on AR15.com, and I will try my best to check my IMs during the show and get your question online for a guest. So pour yourself a nice cold drink of your favorite drink of choice, kick back, and enjoy your favorite Internet talk radio show. Right now, let's go straight to our NRA board member, Joe DeBurgolace. Joe, are you there?
Hi, John. How are you today?
Doing outstanding. I understand you took a shotgun class this weekend.
Actually, I did. I was out there trudging through the snow up here in Buffalo, New York, and became certified as a shotgun instructor, so I can add that to my list of credentials as a certified NRA instructor.
That is outstanding. In the snow and cold, neither rain nor snow nor dark of night, huh?
Oh, I told you. It was one of those things where it was a lot of fun. Great bunch of people, kindred spirit. We had a fantastic instructor by the name of Chuck Parker. He's been doing it for a lot of years. It's just always nice to be around a lot of fellow NRA members.
Now, I have a quick question for you. What's the difference between taking a course to be an instructor and just taking a course?
Well, you need to be certified in order to instruct a wide variety of NRA course offerings. There's basic pistol, shotgun, rifle, refuse to be a victim, personal defense inside the house, personal defense outside the house, and a variety of others. So what this does is bring you to a level of an instructor. It teaches you a variety of basic teaching lessons, how to construct your curriculum, how to teach from the coursework. So it's actually a challenging course. The NRA does a great job. It's one of the committees I sit on, the Education and Training Committee. Mitch Mitchell and Bill Poole do a fantastic job at headquarters.
Oh, okay.
If anybody's interested, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
If anybody's interested in becoming an instructor, all the information you'll need, it will go to, it can be found on our website, www.nra.org.
Now, one question I had for you was, it's not really a question. I just was unaware that you were on that committee, the training committee. That's pretty interesting. Are you on any other committees?
I am, John. I currently serve on the President's Commission on Three Guns, the Law Enforcement Committee, Grassroots, which is all the activism we talk about on a weekly basis here.
And I think we're going to have one of the Grassroots guys come and talk to us next week.
Oh, great. That's great. Yeah. It's the Grassroots Division, I always say, and to anybody who will listen, I think it's one of the most demanding as well as most active divisions within the NRA itself. That's where you actually see the rubber hit the road and we get the most traction out of what we do. You guys do a great job.
Speaking of rubber hitting the road, we've got a big lawsuit being settled tomorrow, the big one everyone knows about, McDonald versus Chicago. Can you just brief everyone quickly on the situation there?
Sure, John. As most people know, tomorrow's the deliberation start in a landmark McDonald versus the City of Chicago, where the Supreme Court justices will begin deliberations and hear an oral arguments on this vital issue, which will incorporate the Second Amendment. It's going to be an interesting day tomorrow. I invite anyone who would like to listen. There'll be special reports, what have you, on both NRANews.com, and I'm sure we'll be doing things on ARFCOM as well.
Okay, and just so everybody knows, this is the lawsuit for, this is basically the Heller lawsuit in Chicago, right? It's basically Heller revisited.
Well, Heller was specifically for federal enclaves, the District of Columbia, federal reservations, that type of thing. This goes to the state.
Oh, okay.
Incorporates the federal our rights as citizens of this great country and incorporate those rights into the state. That's why it's very vital that we have a favorable decision.
Okay, yeah, that's very important. Let's talk a little bit about the situation in Delaware. They legalized the possession of firearms for lawful citizens in public housing projects, and then there seems to have been some action taken since then?
Well, there has been. Led by our former president, John Sigler, who's doing a great job out in Delaware, he and the folks over at the Caesar Rodney Institute instituted this lawsuit, and with the help of the NRA ILA, Chris Cox specifically, we challenged the ruling on behalf of the state of Delaware as to where if you are a resident of public housing, you have to forego your Second Amendment rights to bear arms. Now, what we did do, as a result of the lawsuit, we had one of the housing complex board of directors, if you will, decided to say, that's it, as long as you can lawfully carry a firearm, you're fine. So one down, three to go. There seems to be an issue with Attorney General Bo Biden, the son of Vice President Biden, and he's the one that John and the good folks over at Caesar Rodney are going to be contending another lawsuit as to the interpretation of the Second Amendment in Delaware. And what's curious about that, John, is that the Second Amendment, which is basically outlined in their Article 1, Section 20 of the Delaware Constitution, states a person has the right to keep and bear arms in defense of self, family, home and state, and for hunting and recreational use. And it says nothing in there about housing residents being exempted.
Right.
So the vice president's son, who is, and I give him credit, he just returned back from Iraq. He served as a member of the National Guard over there, is taking on this issue. So what the housing authorities and the board of directors of this particular complex are doing are waiting for a ruling from the state.
So it's going to end up going to who eventually, and who's going to end up being the final deciders on this?
Well, what will happen is the attorney general, who is the chief law enforcement officer and chief counselor, if you will, for the state, will render his decision. If it's contrary to that of the Constitution, which would be very hard given what I just read,
right,
there'll be a lawsuit instituted by John Sigler and company.
Okay. On behalf of gun owners.
On behalf of the gun owners and residents of those housing projects.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And another case of the NRA working for citizens' gun rights, even if it's
yes,
not
sir.
always even if it's not always, you know, the typical citizen that you'd expect. I mean, I don't expect that there are a high number of NRA members living in the housing projects there, but they're still citizens nonetheless, and the NRA is fighting for them.
Well, certainly, and let's remember, John, we have, thankfully, over 4 million members of the NRA currently in building. I encourage everybody out there who is not a member of the NRA to join. But we represent close to 80 million plus firearm-owning citizens. And then you extrapolate that out to, I think we're over 300 million residents of this country. We carry the water for the great whole of the nation.
Yeah.
So we don't really, we encourage you to join, but it's not mandatory for us to pick up the fight.
Right. And just so everyone knows, if you're not a member of the NRA, please take your time to go join. Are you guys still having a lifetime membership drive right now?
We have a membership drive going on constantly. There's a couple special offerings out there. If anybody has any interest in joining, please feel free to IM me, direct action, on ARFCOM. I'll put you in connection with the right person. But there's a variety of things. You can go right onto the site. ARFCOM is a big supporter of the NRA, and you can join right through the recruiting process set up by the Avila family there on the site.
Yeah, the Avilas certainly are big supporters of the NRA. As should every gun owner be, despite if you may have some misgivings about the way anything has ever been handled, you cannot dispute the fact of all the good that the NRA does for gun owners in America. Now, one thing I wanted to talk with you about today was there's a sheriff in Las Vegas, apparently, who thinks it's a good idea that everybody register their guns. Now, what's the situation down there? What's going on? As far as I knew, you had to already register your guns, don't you, if you are a resident of Las Vegas?
You do. What he's asking is people come in on a blue card, and this is the contention, and articulate to them, to the officers and the sheriff's deputies, as to what firearms they have. And the residents are up in arms over it, pun intended, stating that it's on par with that of a variety of countries where it failed, and we can articulate those through history. But they really don't want to sit there because they believe it's going to mark them or it's going to basically profile them as a gun owner. So I called down to a few of my friends down there who will work on Metro PD. Fantastic individuals. It's a great department. It truly is. And the best way for us to sit there is obviously politely email and send letters and make telephone calls like we always do when we want to change legislation or change a policy. But the other thing is, instead of registering our guns, why don't we register to vote? When you register to vote, take the 5 minutes it takes to go into the polling booth and to elect an official that it perhaps has a policy that which coincides with that of the Second Amendment or whatever of the Constitution of the United States of America or that of the Bill of Rights. That's the best and strong way. We can send a message.
The bums out of office.
That's the easiest way. And you'd be surprised, John. It's you know, Kevin coming back from CPAC, we talked about that last week, and a variety of other things. A lot of people who don't want to register for a variety of reasons, one being they don't want to serve on jury duty. But it's just, if you register to vote, there are some obligations that come with that. Take the 5 minutes, research your people who are so inclined to follow your philosophy of government, and then go to the voting booth. If you go to the voting booth and vote your way or vote your vote, then you can sit there and complain all you want. It doesn't turn your way. If not, you can't let the NRA carries the water for everybody else who's not a member. We really need you to get involved and go to the polling booth. That's why the Tea Party is so popular right now, but you can't change the process if you're not part of it.
Absolutely. So in short, if you don't want to register your guns, you better register to vote.
Most certainly, and that's something we can apply across the country.
All right, Joe. Hey, you know, I wish we had a few more minutes here, but we're up against the wall. I've got to pack all these guests in here today. I really appreciate you coming on with us each week. Joe DeBurgle is his name. His name on ARFCOM is Direct Action. If you have any questions NRA-related or gun law-related, feel free to send him an IM. Is that right, Joe?
That's right, John. Looking forward to talk to everybody. Please feel free to IM me, call me. My number is already listed throughout the threads. John, you have a great show.
Okay, thanks. We look forward to talking to you next week. Right now, we have a get-to-know segment, a brand new one. This week, get-to-know is Pangea. He's quite a colorful character on ARFCOM, and we're going to get to know him just a little bit better right now. Okay, we have another great get-to-know segment for you this week. We've got a member who's been around since January, the end of January of 2001, so he's been here a long time. He's seen a lot of different things come and go on ARFCOM. This week's get-to-know is Pangea. How are you doing today, Pangea?
Well, I'm getting by. Not too bad for an old man.
Did you get dumped on with any of the snow?
Yes, I did. Well, not this round, but a couple of weeks ago I got a pretty good bit.
You got the last round. That's right. You're in Tennessee, right?
Yes, I am. Southern Tennessee.
Okay. Without any further ado, here we go. First question, 9mm or 45?
45.
45 all the way, huh? Okay.
You bet.
Beans or no beans?
Both. I'm sorry, both.
Well, you're going to have to clarify that.
I like chili verde without beans, and I like red chili with beans.
Okay, that's fair enough. Glock 1911 or something else?
1911.
1911 guy, we knew that was coming. Married, single, or in a relationship?
Married for a long time.
Okay. Does your wife support your firearms and your shooting?
Yeah, she supports it pretty good. Tolerate it's more like it.
Tolerates it, huh? Any kids?
Yeah. Yeah, I've got two kids.
Do they shoot?
When they can, yeah. They're pretty busy with their lives right now, but they shoot when they can.
Sure, okay. Okay. What do you do for a living, Pangea?
Work in the R&D on the Ares Orion project for the NASA.
That sounds very interesting. Yeah, that's a cool job. Okay, what is your drink of choice?
Soft drink or hard liquor?
Your go-to drink of choice. When you sit down in front of ARFCOM for a nice long session, what do you have in front of you usually?
I have me some Knob Creek on the rocks.
Knob Creek on the rocks. That sounds very, very tasty, actually.
Yes,
who is your favorite poster on ARFCOM? Whose post do you really enjoy reading?
I like Mr. Clean for Hire.
That guy is funny, isn't he?
He's a blast, man.
That guy, man, he can do more funny stuff with one line than some of us that take paragraphs to make something funny. That guy is a riot.
I gotta meet him.
Oh, you met him?
No, I said I've got to meet him.
Oh, yeah, I've got to meet him, too. He'd be a fun guy to sit down for a couple of drinks with. Who is your least favorite poster on ARFCOM? Whose post do you think we could do without?
Oh, I'm thinking one of those Canadians. Is it Toaster? Something like that or something? Toaster, Taster?
Oh, we finally get someone to commit to a name. Okay, I know who you're talking about. I think everybody else does, too. Who is your favorite ARFCOM mod or site staff?
I have to be Aimless.
Aimless. Oh, yeah. I love Aimless.
I met him. I shot with him at a shoot up in Camden, Tennessee once. A nice guy.
Oh, okay. You've met him. Cool. Mm-hmm. If you could live anywhere other than Tennessee where you live now, where would that be?
Ooh, it would have to be Louisiana, my home.
Oh, Louisiana. That's where you're from originally, huh?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, we finally get someone that doesn't answer Texas. That's good. Everyone else has answered Texas to that question. Okay, on to some guns. What is your favorite firearm that you currently own?
My current favorite would have to be my AR-15.
Oh, okay. Well, what kind of build is it? Is it a factory
build? It's a lift lower and a Franken gun upper and everything, just podge, put together stuff.
Okay, cool. Well, and how does it shoot for you?
Every time it goes bang, and it's pretty accurate for what it is.
Okay, right on. What kind of lower did you say that was?
It's an Olympic lower.
Nice. And they fit together pretty well, huh?
Oh, yeah, it went together good. In fact, I put it together in front of an ARFCOM screen in 1999. I actually joined in 99, and I put this gun together out of parts on my lap looking at my computer screen on ARFCOM.
Oh, wow, that's a cool story. Okay, so you've actually been a member since 99, but, okay, on your profile it says 2001. That's where I got the 2000.
Yeah, they all defaulted to that when the board changed over back then.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. No, thank you.
Yeah, you won't see anybody listed as before that date.
Okay, so when I see people registered for that 2001 date, now I know that they've probably been there for longer than that. Okay, cool. See, I get to learn a whole lot of things with these get-to-knows. Let's see where we're. Okay, here we go. If you could have any one firearm that's legal for you to own that you do not currently own, what would that be?
That would have to be a M82A1 Barrett.
Oh, yeah, Barrett. Those are lovely. Those are lovely. And especially after you hear some of Nick Randstad's stories, it's just like, oh, get me a Barrett. When was the last time you went shooting, Pangea?
Last time I went serious shooting was probably Christmas Day. I plink every once in a while around the house.
Okay. You plink around the house. What is that? You have a range there at your house, or?
No, I have enough, a small amount of land that I can shoot 22, like the Aguilas, Super Aguilas.
Oh, yeah.
I just shoot it at a little spinner in my yard, and no one's in danger that way.
Those are those primer onlys, right?
Yeah. They're not accurate for beans, but they're fun to shoot.
Yeah, okay. I've got a few of those myself, actually. Have you ever met a fellow ARFCOMer in real life? You already addressed this.
Oh, yeah, I've met several of them.
And what was your general impression of them?
All of them are stand-up guys. I'd go to war with any of them.
Right on. That's a great answer. What is your favorite non-GD section of the forums?
I guess it would be the hometown section.
Okay, hometown forums. Right on. I spend a little bit of time in my hometown forum. I don't post too much, but I do post occasionally. What was the first firearm that you ever shot?
First firearm I ever shot, I was 5 years old and shot a model 97 Winchester pump shotgun.
Oh, wow, a shotgun. See, most people, it's a 22. That's cool. Was that your
dad?
Yeah,
my daddy propped it up. Yep, he propped up that big 12-gauge on the fence post and knocked me on my butt.
And you loved shooting ever since, huh?
I was hooked, man. I couldn't get enough.
That's awesome. Okay, have you ever gotten rid of a firearm and regretted it?
I don't get rid of firearms.
A good policy. That's a good policy.
I'm in the acquisition mode.
You take, but you do not give.
That's right.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your avatar here. Now, that's an interesting picture you've got there. It looks like you got a hillbilly black guy with a
badge. Actually, that's Beetlejuice. He's some kind of radio personality kind of thing. I don't know. I just saw the picture on the internet, and I thought it was kind of humorous, and I put it on there, and you get kind of used to it. So,
and people identify with you every time they see that picture. I know I do that picture.
Yeah, I went to a Fleur de Lis for a while, and no one knew who I was, so I went back to Beetlejuice.
Oh, okay. All right, last question: if you were elected president of the United States, what would be the first thing you would do as president?
Two chicks at one time, man.
So you would take Bill Clinton and go to the next level with it, huh?
No, not really. I would probably pass the fair tax law.
Oh, fair tax law. Okay, right on. We have a tax rights guy. Outstanding. Well, I appreciate the interview, Pangea. Now everybody on ARFCOM knows you just a little bit better. And thanks for taking some time out for us today.
Anytime, brother. Anytime.
Okay. And next week we'll have another great get to know for you. Right here on Radio Free ARFCOM. Okay, and we're back. I have some bad news for all my listeners, and I hate that this happened. This has never happened to me before, but one of my book guests has had to cancel. We had Mir Javendifar. He was a Middle East analyst for MEEPERS. There was some confusion with the time difference and the exact hour he was going to be on, and he's not going to be able to be with us today, and I really apologize to everybody who was looking forward to hearing from him. I myself was really looking forward to hearing from him, and I feel like I've kind of let my listeners down on this one, but some of these things cannot be avoided when you're dealing across international time zones, and I want to apologize to everyone in advance. So that being said, we're going to go right on to our next guest. His name is John Roth. He's an author and a firearms trainer, author of the book Unintended Consequences, which has been quite a controversial book. John, how are you today?
Very good. Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit first about your history with firearms and how you got started shooting. I'm sure it was when you were a young boy like most of us. And what made you get into the firearms to the extent that you are now, get into the gun culture, as you call it?
Well, I started shooting when I was 7 years old, and I never outgrew it.
what was that? You started shooting, I'm sure your dad took you out?
Yeah.
And one of the questions I always ask when we have a get-to-know segment was, what was the first gun you ever shot? Do you remember the first gun you ever shot?
Yes, it was a 22 pump action Belgian Browning.
Oh, wow, that sounds pretty interesting, actually. Yeah, most of us start out with a 22. Although Pangea, of course, started out with the 12-gauge, went straight to the big guns. So let's talk a little bit about your novel, Unintended Consequences. You wrote it 1996, correct?
Yes.
And is it out of print now?
No. We're just getting ready to do the seventh printing in soft cover. It's being printed as we speak, and it'll come out in about 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay. So 2 or 3 weeks, everyone can look forward to a new printing of Unintended Consequences. For those that don't know the basic plot line of it, without giving too much away, can you go over kind of what it's about?
Yeah, it's the culture of freedom against the culture of state control.
Okay, you want to talk maybe a little bit more about it as far as like the main character and that type of thing?
Well, the main character has grown up in the gun culture, and he's witnessed Waco and Ruby Ridge and a bunch of other things. And one night he's at his friend's house in Indiana, and he thinks they're trying to attack his friend's house with the a bunch of thugs, and he realizes after he uses his shooting skills that they're not a bunch of thugs. They're a bunch of federal agents that have used the federal agents that have used the what am I looking for here?
I'm not sure exactly what word you're looking for, but basically the federal agents come kicking down the door. They think it's some criminal.
Yeah, right.
And they
federal
fight
agents
back.
Looking for the use the I'm trying to remember what we're talking about here.
That's okay.
The asset forfeiture laws.
Oh, okay.
To take everything his friend has.
Okay.
And that's what the story's about.
So you wrote this book back in 1996. It's been all the way up to the number 7 bestseller on Amazon. When you wrote it, did you ever think it would get those kind of numbers?
No idea.
What was your basic impetus for writing it? Was it just you had some thoughts you wanted to get off your chest, or you felt that this was something?
Well, I was giving speeches about what was going on in Missouri, and someone said, you know, you ought to write a history book. And I said, well, you know, that'd be another book no one would ever read. And I said, well, you know, Ken Follett or someone else that does history fiction mm-hmm. ought to write this. And I realized that, well, Ken's probably got something else to do in his life, but I could do this. So that's how the book got started.
Okay. So now, if I understand correctly, Timothy McVeigh actually read this book after he was incarcerated. Is that correct?
Yes.
And his quote I actually saw on Wikipedia said, "If people say the Turner Diaries was my Bible, Unintended Consequences would be my New Testament. I think Unintended Consequences is a better book. It might have changed my whole plan of operation if I'd read that one first." What were your thoughts when you heard that?
Well, the reality is I wrote my book while he was doing his thing in Oklahoma City, and I wrote it after he blew up the federal building.
Oh, okay.
So you have to understand, He said that about my book in prison, and you know, there's a lot of speculation about what he was thinking when he was in prison, but my book wasn't done until after the fact.
Right, until so it wouldn't have influenced anything he had, but it had to have been kind of almost surreal to hear someone like him talking about your work, though.
Yeah, that was surreal.
Now, there has been some controversy about the ATF wanting to ban Unintended Consequences. Is that right? Did they actually want to try to actually get it banned?
Well, I'm not sure. We did have some ATF agents trying what word am I looking for here? They were trying to prevent people from selling it in gun shows. And that happened in several states. And my publisher put out a reward for people that had tried to subvert this and said, hey, look, you know, we'll put out money to anyone that can prevent, or anyone that can prove that ATF has tried to subvert this novel. And as soon as that reward came out, it quit happening.
Oh, okay. So as soon as you guys put the reward out there, then all of the incidents of the ATF trying to pull your book out of the gun show stopped, huh?
Right.
Now, is it true that there were actually ATF agents that gave some trouble to your wife?
Well, we're not sure. My ex-wife got harassed on the street, and the ATF basically said, we don't know who did this. We don't know what's going on. it was someone that we don't have any control over. That's
but it
what
was,
they
it
said.
Was an ATF agent, though?
We don't know.
Oh, you don't even know who it was, huh?
Right.
And it got to the point where your lawyer actually had to send a letter to the ATF?
Right.
And I tried to find a copy of that lawyer online, but apparently it's been, or the letter that your lawyer sent online, but apparently that's been taken down. I don't know.
I don't think so. I think that's still available online, but, you know, I don't know.
Okay, yeah, that's just crazy that you had a couple of people bother your wife like that over your book. Did you ever think when you wrote it that it would cause kind of the storm for your life that it caused?
No idea. I had no idea it was going to do that.
Yeah, that's just crazy. Now, your book is mostly sold was mostly sold at gun shows and stuff. Now, if someone wanted to get a copy, I was looking now, there's upwards of $100 some of these copies online. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, that's because we haven't gotten the seventh printing out. My publisher is going to have copies probably in about 3 or 4 weeks. And it'll be back at $30 again.
Okay, good. I'm sure that's a lot of people wanted to hear that. There was actually a big thread earlier today on AR15.com about your book and why it was out of print and how people could get a copy of it. So
no,
I'm sure
it's not out of print. It's
well,
going to be back.
The next printing hasn't been put out yet.
Right.
Right. Okay. And I was reading on your website, actually, that the way these big bookstores work is they get books and they mostly keep books that are recent, within 6 months to a year old.
Yeah.
And then what do they do? They, once it's get past a certain sales point, they take it out and move on to the next hottest thing.
Yeah, that's the way it usually works for book printing. We're doing it the old fashioned way. Word of mouth.
And it seems to have worked for you. I mean, you were all the way up to number 7 on Amazon.
Right.
Do you ever get people come up to you with a copy and want an autograph?
All the time.
Do you,
I'm glad to do it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you are. Do you hit the gun show circuit at all? Still?
Not for a while. But I have.
Okay. Now, there was a rumor maybe 10 years ago or so, maybe a little bit less, that you actually had a heart attack and died. Now,
rumors of my death are largely exaggerated. No, I didn't have a heart attack. I had a brain aneurysm.
Oh, okay.
And my right side was paralyzed for a while, but now it's okay.
Okay. Now, are you still planning on writing a sequel or another book in the Unintended Consequences series?
Oh yeah, I'm still working on that, and I had to throw a bunch of things away that didn't fit in with what we're experiencing now. But, yeah, I'm going to do that.
How long do you think it'll be till the sequel's out for people to read?
Probably another year and a half.
Okay. Now, I understand you also do firearms training. Is that right?
Yes.
And how did you get involved into the training side of it?
Well, I've been doing that for a long time. I was a police firearms trainer in 1976 was my first year. And now that we've got concealed carry in Missouri, I've been doing that every week.
Okay. And what classes actually do you teach? Do you just teach a concealed carry class?
Yes, and I also teach people how to shoot things out of the air with rifle and pistol and, you know, single projectile weapons. I have a place to shoot that's in an abandoned rock quarry, and that's why, you know, we can do that kind of stuff. I do that also as well as concealed carry.
Oh, okay. Now let's talk a little bit about you shooting things out of the air with single projectile weapons. I don't think everyone really probably understood what you were talking about. Now, you'll take a rifle, a little carbine, and you'll shoot clay pigeons with it. Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, how did you get started with that? Was it just you were out with some friends and someone said, hey, let's try it with the carbine, or?
Well, no, not exactly. But I've always wanted to learn how to do things that other people can't do, and that was one of them. And I teach people that. Because I've got a safe place to do it.
So how do you teach them? Like, what techniques do you use to teach them?
Well, I show them the right position to hold the gun, and then we just on the pedal for the. The thrower, which is run off a 12-volt battery, and pretty soon they get the hang of the swing and start breaking clay birds.
Now, if I understand right, you actually shot clay pigeons down with a 50 cal. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was that? Tell me a little bit about that. Like, is it just? You just had a 50 BMG there?
You've got a thrower that throws the birds in the same position every time. And I used a 16-pound 50 rifle built like a guy out in Arizona. And, you know, when the bird presents itself in the same place every time, you just you shoot it. And I did that in front of 4,000 or 5,000 people at Knob Creek in Kentucky.
Uh-huh. Do you go to the Knob Creek shoot every year?
I used to. I've got too much going on now. Haven't been there for a while, but yeah.
So I read on your website, going back to the 50 cal, that you were using incendiary ammunition.
Yes, I was using incendiary, and it would blow up on a clay bird, which was a real crowd pleaser.
Let's talk a little bit about the political situation we're in now. When you originally wrote Unintended Consequences, we had Ruby Ridge, we had Waco. The ATF was in full force, FBI was in full force going around strong-arming people. They have changed their tactics somewhat to be less, to be less blatant about what they do, but they're still active in what they do. Do you see any similarities between some of the things that have happened recently and some of the stuff that was going on in the 90s?
I'm not sure. You may be more up on this than I am, but I think they're worried that they don't want to do anything that could negatively impact their situation.
Okay. Now, if I understand correctly, you're a financial analyst. Is that correct?
I was. I have retired from that business, and now I'm writing and doing gun training full-time.
Do you still follow the financial situation in the economy?
A little bit. Why? What do you want to know?
I just wanted to get your take on where we're at now with so much debt in the country. Obama seems to have a blank check he wants to write for everybody. I just wanted to see what your take kind of was on things. Sounds like California...
Well, my take is that the free market is, you know, a really good indicator and a good, I don't know what word I want to use here, a good
thermometer?
Well, more than that, it's a good good thing to I don't know what word I want to use here. I'm sorry, I'm not doing this terribly well, but the free market, it's results driven, and if there's something that you need to get done, the free market is very good at figuring out what needs to happen and making that thing result in what you're looking to have done. And when you have the government involved, they're mainly focused on getting their whatever it is, what am I trying to say? Their issues, getting money for that. And, you know, that's not what we really need.
Well, hey, John, I want to thank you for being on the show with us today. Hopefully we can get you on again later. Get to work on that second part of Unintended Consequences. You've got a lot of readers out there that want to hear it. And thanks for being a part of the show. All right, let's go straight to the box of truth. Hopefully we can get Old Painless on here to kick things up a notch, get us through this second hour a lot smoother than this first hour went. Here we go with the box of truth.
Let's open the box of truth. Here is Old Painless.
Hello, everyone. This is Old Painless from the Box of Truth. Today I'm going to talk about reloading or hand-loading ammunition. Most of us that enjoy firearms as a hobby also enjoy shooting them, and this means we need a supply of ammunition. And ammunition costs money. It's not very long till we realize that if only we could recycle some of the brass from our ammo, we might be able to save some money. First, let me admit that today we are seeing an unusual blip on the screen regarding reloading costs. Having a socialist as president and with crazy people in charge in Congress, The prices of reloading components have skyrocketed in recent months. But this will eventually come down, and reloading will once again be much cheaper than buying new ammo. Most of us get into reloading as a cost-saving measure, but we usually find that we don't really save much money, but instead we just shoot more for the same amount of money. That's a good thing. If you think about it, one of the most expensive parts of a cartridge is a brass case. There's no reason to throw these away, as they can be recycled and reused many times, and that'll save us a lot of money. As a reloader, you find yourself being kind of a nut about policing up yours and anyone else's brass. You just hate to let it go to waste. I remember reading an old reloader's story about how he had an old pistol with unusual brass that was kind of hard to find. He carefully kept all his brass and reloaded it over and over. He once took a friend to a local dump to shoot his revolver and let the friend shoot it first. He said that just as he was turning around, the friend had finished firing a cylinder full and had emptied the cylinder into his hand and was throwing it just as far as he could into the dump. The old reloader told him, "Next time you want to throw something, just let me know and I'll give you a handful of quarters." To make it as simple as possible, reloading is simply taking fired brass, knocking out the spent primer, resizing the case back to its original dimensions, adding a new primer, belling the mouth of the case a little, adding some smokeless powder, inserting a new bullet, and then crimping the new bullet in place. When you've done that, you have a brand new cartridge ready to shoot again. Now I'll give you the best advice about reloading that you'll ever get. Get a modern reloading manual like a Speer or Hornady reloading manual and carefully read the entire section about how to reload before you do anything, including buying any reloading equipment. Reloading is simple and easy to do, but you must know what you're doing or you can get in a lot of problems. The first thing you want to do is to understand the process completely before you even start. It takes the same kind of equipment to reload pistols and rifle ammo. It takes a couple of extra steps to reload rifle ammo, and it must be done correctly or you'll have problems. When I got into reloading, I had an old friend named Rudy that kind of took me through the process step by step and helped me get started. I would highly recommend for any new reloader to try to find an experienced reloader to get some help. Not only can you save some money, but you can also are able to custom design ammo for a particular firearm and for a specific purpose. You simply cannot buy off-the-shelf ammo that is as finely tuned to a firearm as reloads can be. For instance, I load target quality ammo for several revolvers and pistols that I cannot find at any price on store shelves. And it's a great feeling to shoot some ammo that you've custom designed and have it shoot in a very small group. It adds a lot to the pleasure of the sport to shoot your own custom ammo. Of course, factory ammo is also fun to shoot, but most reloaders can design ammo that's much more specific to their needs and will shoot as accurately as, or even more accurately, than factory ammo. So if you don't reload, look into it and think about expanding your hobby, because it's fun to shoot stuff.
Okay, and we are back. Live at Radio Free ARFCOM, I'm your host, John Gold, and I would like to apologize to all my listeners for this last hour. This has not been the best show we could have put together for you, and I really apologize for that. We're just going to go ahead and bang right through, kick it up a notch here. We've got someone with a lot more energy coming on, Matt Hoffman of Going Galt. Matt, how are you today?
Thanks for having me, John. I'm doing good. Yeah, that last hour I was getting ready to kill some kittens or something, maybe pull some teeth.
That was, yeah. It's all right. We'll kick it up a notch here. Let's talk a little bit about Going Galt. Let's get started right away here. People want to know, have been asking me, what exactly is this Going Galt segment supposed to be all about? Is it supposed to be am I supposed to be a rebel? Am I supposed to be some type of revolutionary? What exactly are our goals here with Going Galt?
No. Understanding the idea of Going Galt is a lot easier if you are reading or have read Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. It's not about It's not about picking up arms. It's not about leading protests, writing your senators, or anything like that. It's essentially, in a word, dropping out. It's a way of personally removing yourself from a system that you see as corrupt, taking your money, and finding every way possible to just get out of it and care only about yourself and your well-being. The whole society be damned. You can only do so much with that, but you're in total control of your own life. It's an acknowledgement of that and an embracement of that.
So what we're going to talk about here is different strategies, different tactics, things people can put to use every day in their lives to help them to actively fight against some of the things that are against our Constitution, basically, that are anti-capitalist, that are anti-freedom. You're going to go over some tax things today with us, Obama's 2008 tax return. You're going to talk a little bit about corporations, how people can incorporate themselves and actually make money, as well as save tax money, but not only save tax money, but make money. Is that right?
That's about the gist of it, yeah.
Okay, let's start a little bit with a guy who had problems with the tax man here a couple of weeks ago, Joe Stack. Now, this guy is not an example of what we're talking about going gold.
No, this is totally almost the opposite of it. In fact, one of the things that really concerned me about this whole incident was the suicide note or manifesto, call it what you want, that he left behind. Because if you read through it, it's really, really easy to dismiss it as the words of a psychopath. It's too easy, in fact. And that's the problem, because even though it may be 99.5% nonsense and rambling, there were a few things in there that touched on what is the idea of going gold. And my biggest concern is that, thank God it didn't happen, media, politicians would seize on these and say, okay, these ideas are the exact mindset of people who are domestic terrorists and want to attack our government and citizens. And that's not the case at all. Fortunately, that didn't happen. But I was really worried there for a little bit that they were going to seize on that, push it, and we'd start to see a turn of opinion, or we'd even start to see maybe some citizen-on-citizen violence between different ideologies. Again, glad we didn't have it, but Joe Stack didn't go gold. Joe Stack went crazy.
Yeah, Joe Stack was a loony bin, and if anybody got to read that, I don't even know if you could call it a manifesto. It was more just the ramblings of a madman. It seemed like all of his problems were brought on him by himself.
Right. That's something that it doesn't seem like that's a problem that he recognized. That's a problem that a lot of people have that they don't recognize, but they don't fly planes into buildings. A lot of people are in bad financial shape or having problems. They're not as free as they think they are, and the biggest problem with that is that they don't recognize that. And that's what Going Gold is doing. It's there to sort of help shine a light on the path, help you see the true situation you're in so you can figure out what you need to do.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the Obama 2008 tax return. A lot of us don't even really understand the tax system. It's just gotten so big and so unwieldy. I'll bet there's IRS people that have no clue about 80% of the tax law and what goes on with the government and all that. You want to go ahead and talk about that?
Sure thing. Now, as you mentioned, God knows there's nothing more complex in this world, string theory, relativity, all that, compared to the United States tax code. But the basic way to sum it down is that the best way to go gold is to use this to your advantage. The income tax return that we file every year is the keystone to going gold. And the best two ways to take advantage of that are to leverage deductions and credits. I went ahead and I dug up the 2008 tax return from Barack and Michelle Obama, and I took a look at that. And I'd like to present some notes that I saw on it. I'd done the 2009, but I wasn't able to find it. I don't even know if they filed it.
Sure. So just so everyone's clear, this is the actual tax return that Barack and Michelle Obama filed jointly for the 2008 year. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And now I'm sure we're talking some pretty big numbers here.
Hey, you might be surprised, but it depends on what you're using as big.
Well, big to me was, well, I'm sure.
Big to you, big
to me.
Big to
me is not
yes.
that big. Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Let's get started on that. I'm sure this is going to be pretty interesting.
Well, all right, the first place to start is its income tax, so obviously we want to see what their income is. I'm going to just round up for simplicity's sake, but their income tax return for 2008 showed that they earned a little over $2.7 million that year. Now, the IRS tax bracket, sorry?
That's big money to me.
Me too. Well, wait until you get to these other big numbers. The IRS tax bracket for that year, for that income, indicates that they owe $96,770 plus 35% of the amount they earned over $357,700. Mathematically, this works out to them owing about $930,000 in taxes. Think about that.
Wow.
$930,000 in income tax. That's
wow.
a big number.
Now, yeah, and you said they only made, what did you say their total income was?
2.7.
So, wow, they're at 35%-ish, something like that?
About 97,000 plus 35% of all the income they made over about 357,000.
Now, let me just guess. We haven't even talked about this in depth, and let me just guess. That's not what they actually ended up paying.
Nope.
Okay.
Not even near.
So let's go ahead and get into that.
All right. Now, the Obamas paid only about $855,000 in income tax that year. That's a difference of $75,000, which is more than what the average American makes per year.
Right.
$75,000 that they didn't pay in income taxes. But this is totally legal. They used tax credits and deductions, and it came to an adjusted gross income of about $2.6 million. That's $100,000 of income of theirs that was completely excluded from taxation for that year.
So let's talk a little bit about those credits and deductions. What type of deductions did they use, for instance?
Well, there's all kinds of deductions you can use, but one of the big ones that a lot of people surprisingly don't use is the charitable contributions one. Now, a lot of the times, the reason people don't do this is they say, well, it's still money out of my pocket. That's true. Giving money to charity, it's coming out of your pocket. However, your money's going to do a lot more good in, say, aiding research for cystic fibrosis or Alzheimer's than it is to a welfare rat who's going to use it to buy liquor and booze.
Right.
So if you're going to lose money out of your pocket anyway, you might as well give it to a good cause. Every dollar you give to charity, even time, you can get a deduction on volunteer time for charity. Is less money
you
that
can.
You pay the government.
You can get a deduction for hours volunteered?
I believe so. I need to double check on that, but I believe that's what I saw, yes.
Oh, that's very interesting if that's the truth. So we got tax time coming up now. What are some of the deductions people need to be looking at other than the charitable contributions?
Well, the most common one that people have is mortgage interest. Not many people really even know that this is something they can deduct until that form shows up in the mail and they go to their accountant or they pull up TurboTax or they go to H&R Block. But mortgage interest is deductible. You can also deduct almost every local or state tax that you pay from your federal.
You can't.
Right. There's a section that it asks you what your state income tax was, and it will have an impact on your federal tax.
Oh, see, I never knew that. So,
well, I do admit we're kind of getting into gray areas. Like I said, the tax code is just incredibly complex. And
so one thing everyone should know right off the bat.
Areas that I haven't even broken the surface on yet, so I can't really say for 100% everything we've been talking about. But there are a few that I am absolutely positive on.
So make sure you check with your accountant, as always, before you fly that return off to the IRS, right?
Always, always, always. And one thing that a lot of people miss is that they usually go and talk to their accountant after tax time comes around. Okay, what can I deduct from this past year? Well, it's too late to change that. It is what the situation is, and you can't go back and do anything about that. If you threw away a receipt, oops, too bad. Ask your accountant about what you can do to deduct for the coming year. Then you know what to save, what documentation to get. That way you can better plan what your taxes are going to be, as opposed to at the end of the year, oh, God, I wonder what I'm going to get in a refund this year if I get one. No, you'll know.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about credits. How do the credits work, and what did the Obamas use as some of their credits?
I unfortunately don't have that in front of me right now. It was more of a assessment of total amount that they paid versus what they earned and
okay.
how
what
they
about
took advantage
credits?
Of
it. What about credits, though? How exactly does that work? Are those government offered credits? Or
credits and deductions are two similar but fundamentally different things. They both impact how much tax you pay by reducing it. The difference is that a credit is a one-for-one match. You pay a dollar towards something that's a tax credit, and that's a dollar less that you will pay. A deductible is not that. A deductible is a percentage. For every dollar, you get to deduct, say, 20 cents or so.
Okay. Okay. That makes a little bit of sense to me. See, with my taxes, I'm always pretty basic. I file the 1040 form, and I just put the numbers in the boxes, and however it comes out is how it comes out. So I've never really sat down to make credits and deductions and all that. However, this year, like, I've got some I've got some capital gains I'm going to have to deal with and stuff like that. Now, it sounds to me like the main thing as far as getting your taxes, reducing your tax footprint, as it were, is you've got to keep pretty decent records.
Right. You also need to figure out what exactly is a legal tax shelter, if you will. You said you're paying some capital gains this year?
Right.
I'm going to guess that's because you bought a stock option bond, something like that, sold it, and then you pocketed the money.
Right. Yeah, it was from some stock. I day traded stocks for most of the year 2009, and so I've got to pay. It turns out to be a pretty jaw-dropping percentage of this money back to the government.
Okay. Well, if you were to buy stocks, bonds, things like that out of, say, a IRA or a 401k, you have deferred the tax on those sales.
Okay. How does that work?
Okay. Let's go ahead and use the...
Does that mean I don't pay it this year, or I pay it? I wouldn't pay it for this year, or I would still have to pay it eventually, or what?
It depends on the situation, but let's just go with a really basic example, a traditional IRA, IRA. It's a tax-sheltered account for retirement, IRA, individual retirement account. The way it works is you put money into it. Usually it's money deducted out of a paycheck, pre-tax. So the money sits in there. It hasn't been taxed. But the trade-off is you can't touch it until you've reached a certain age without incurring tax on it and a penalty. Once you reach that age, however, you can take money out of it at that time, but you're not getting it tax-free. It is being taxed as a part of your income. A lot of people think, well, okay, what's the difference here? I mean, a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow, right? And they are right in that regard. But the thing they're missing is that this gives you control. If you have, say, $5 million sitting in your IRA at the time that you can access it without penalty.
Uh-huh.
You can decide to take $10,000 out of it for that year and only pay income tax on that $10,000, or you could take a full $2.7 million out of it, pay taxes on that. How much you earn affects how much tax you pay. So if you're able to hold money and control how much of it is part of your income and what you pay taxes on, you're going to be in a better situation than if you just say, give me all my money right now.
Okay. That makes a little bit of sense to me. Now, one thing I wanted to talk with you about was LLCs, limited liability corporations, and how those can affect your life. And it sounds like these things are intertwined, that an LLC actually can affect your taxes and that type of thing.
Yes and no. Again, it's situational, but I'm actually in the process of doing this right now, so I can speak from a bit of experience on it. The biggest thing to keep in mind is that businesses are taxed differently than individuals. The big thing that a lot of people see is that the tax rates are different for businesses. Businesses pay higher tax rates in comparison to individuals, and that's true. But there's one thing that they usually don't see, and it's that businesses have a lot more deductions available to them than the individual. Basically, the way to summarize it is businesses can deduct just about every expense it incurs in the pursuit of making a profit. Good example, a real small one, something that people deal with every year. Okay, you own a business, you run that out of your home. You need more printer paper, so you go to the store and buy it. Say $40 for a 5 or 10 ream box of paper. Is it deductible? If you're an individual, it's not. It's a personal expense, and you're going to pay the full income tax rate on the $40 that you earned to then spend on that paper. However, if you're a business and you're buying it for business use, that expense is deductible, which means you'll pay a smaller income tax rate on that $40 than if you were an individual.
Okay, so it reduces the amount of tax you pay for that.
It does.
Okay, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I recently started a limited liability corporation.
Okay.
And the startup costs for that, the actual to get it incorporated and pay all the legal fees and that, were roughly $500. Now, is that $500? Now, how does this work exactly as far as my personal? Do I have my own personal tax return and the LLC is going to have its own return?
Yes and no. It depends on how you do it. Depending on state law, though, most states tend to be in this situation. If you start a limited liability corporation or a limited liability company, depending on how your state defines it, you can elect to either be taxed as a corporation, a separate entity, or you can elect to have a S corporation tax status. Now, the difference there is that in a S corporation tax status, all the income from your LLC is reported on your personal income tax return. There's trade-offs to this. The separate tax entity LLC, all its income is not reported on your personal income tax return. However, you do get into a situation there with something called double taxation. You pay yourself, say, $5,000 from your company's account. Not only are you going to pay taxes on that $5,000, but your company is going to pay taxes on that $5,000. The difference, though, is that the business can deduct that money because that's an expense it incurred in the pursuit of making a profit, namely hiring you for your talent.
Right.
And so the deduction, in your personal tax situation, the one you just described, you spent, say, $500 to start a company. Regardless of whether it's a S-corp tax status or a separate taxable entity, you, on your personal tax return, will be able to deduct that $500 because the IRS does allow you to deduct expenses towards starting a company. But I believe it's limited at several thousand. I want to say 5,000 off the top of my head, but I'm not 100% on that yet.
Okay. So I would be able to deduct that initial expense into my corporate deduction or my personal if I linked the two together.
Yes. If it's an S corp, all your business expenses, all your profit is on your return. So the easier way to think about this is if it's an S corp, from an income tax perspective, you and your company are one. You buy something for the company, even though it might be on, you buy something for your company using your company's money, you get to deduct that expense on your income tax return because your company's income tax return and yours are the same.
Okay.
If it's a separate taxable entity, that's not the case.
Okay. Now, for people that don't know anything about incorporating, can you go ahead and talk to them about how they would go about starting a limited liability corporation for their own uses?
Sure thing. It's actually going to vary a lot depending on where you are. Not just necessarily by state, but also by locality. Some areas have their own requirements. The simplest way for me to explain it is, on top of what I just said, you can deduct expenses for starting a company. You can find all kinds of companies online that will be able to put your company together for you. One that a friend of mine has used before is LegalZoom, and they will just ask you questions. What do you want to set up? You will give them information, and you will pay them a fee for getting this all set up for you.
That's who I used, incidentally.
That's who you used?
Yeah, that's who I used. And if anyone's interested, just a quick hint, if you're going to use LegalZoom, to start, one of the options is to pay an extra fee to expedite it, which means they tell you it's going to take like 6 weeks or so to get everything done. I did not pay the extra fee to expedite it, and mine was completely finished in like 2 weeks. So don't fall for the trap where you have to pay extra to get everything expedited with LegalZoom. They're pretty quick about getting things done.
That is a good comment. My wife and I ran a candle manufacturing business a couple years ago, and we formed it the old-fashioned way. Find all the forms ourselves, go down to the courthouse, file, pay, all that. I can tell you from personal experience, there is an option on LegalZoom to get your employer identification number from the IRS.
Yes.
And I think it's something like a $40 or $50 charge, maybe more.
Yeah, that's one of the ones. I actually did use that one, yes. That's like $50, yeah.
John,
is it worth it?
You could have gotten that yourself from the IRS website in about 10 minutes.
See, I didn't know that.
But that's okay, because that's an expense you incurred making a business, so you can deduct the income tax.
So I can deduct that. Okay, cool. See, I'm learning a little bit here today, and when it comes to deductions, I'm like a real moron. Actually, when it comes to taxes, I'm a real moron. So any help I can get is a lot of help for me.
I actually feel like I'm doing a poor job myself explaining. I had a script that I put together to try to explain it better, but we're pretty much hitting parts of it, so let's continue on.
Go ahead. Were there any major things on your script that you needed to hit? Go ahead and talk about those.
Well, okay, I guess I could give a good example. Someone actually gave this example in the Going Galt thread in the team forum, and I apologize to whomever you are that I don't have your screen name to give you credit. But it was a really good idea, and it was to make a mobile advertisement business and use your vehicle. The idea was make your personal vehicle company property. Sell out advertising space on your vehicle. Now, you've seen cars drive around with these ads on them. That's kind of
right.
What you're going to do. Now,
okay.
One of the things you can do here is that your car is now a part of your business. And driving it around, since you're in advertising, is business-related activity. So not only are you going to earn income from selling space on your vehicle, but because every single time you get behind the wheel of that car, so long as you have ads on it, everywhere you go, it's business because you're advertising. So you would be able to deduct pretty much all the expenses that your vehicle incurs. It's business related. Oil changes, gasoline, car washes, mileage. I mean, think about that. Legally using your vehicle expenses to reduce your income tax burden.
I like that. That counts for everything. It counts oil changes, like you said, new tires.
Well, the idea is that all these repairs, oil changes, and so forth are necessary because you're driving the vehicle around. And since you're in a mobile advertising business, anytime you drive around, so long as you have ads on your vehicle, one could say you're conducting business work. You're advertising. You're out and driving around.
I like it. That's a pretty interesting idea, actually, because you see a lot of these cars driving around town with their little signs on there. Bob's Window Washing or Ken's Landscaping or whatever, and all these people can use this to deduct from their taxes.
Now, I'll go ahead and give you a personal example of what I'm going through forming my own company.
Yeah,
you said you spent about $500 to get a business formed on your end.
Right.
And I said that all expenses that you have up to a certain point forming a business are deductible. Well, thank God
right.
for that, because I just spent about $2,300 yesterday buying gear and equipment I need for a business that I'm starting.
Oh, wow.
Now, this is something that it's going to be related to a hobby I enjoy, being outdoors, climbing, hiking, stuff like that. If I start a business with this, all my purchases related to this qualify for deduction, assuming that I actually have a profit motive in the business. IRS isn't stupid. They are actually out looking for what they call hobby businesses.
Okay.
Think of bands or garden nurseries or even our previous business, candle making. If you cannot prove that you are legitimately in it to make a profit somehow, then they can say, no, no, you're a hobby business. You don't get to deduct those expenses because those aren't related to your business. That's related to your hobby. Now, there's several rules that they use to determine this, but the biggest one is one that they call 3 of 5. And that is if your business has turned a profit within any 3 of the last 5 years, there's very good standing that it is a legitimate for-profit business. If you haven't been making a profit within any 3 of the last 5 years, why are you still in business?
Okay. So that's to try to dissuade people and keep people from just throwing a business up.
Right.
Just the front.
The idea that we're touching on here was actually a lot easier and a lot more popular long ago. People would just buy things, transfer them into a company that they had started, and take advantage of deductions and tax breaks available to companies that weren't available to individuals. Pretty much what we're doing right now, except the IRS figured out, okay, well, these aren't legitimate businesses. So they created a separate structure or a separate tax rate for something called a personal holding company. And it's like 40%. It's the highest rate out there to discourage people from doing this. So there's plenty of great ways to take advantage of business tax deductions, but you have to be in it legitimately to make money.
Okay, so I've got my LLC that I put together, and I originally intended for it to make some money. But say I'm just a poor businessman and I don't make money. Does that mean I should abandon my corporation after a year or two if I'm not making money for fear that the IRS is going to come after me for that?
No, I wouldn't do that. The IRS has sort of an unspoken approach, or maybe it is documented somewhere and I haven't found it. But they essentially expect that a business is going to lose money the first 2 or 3 years. Now, I'll also point out that there is a difference between losing money and losing money on paper. You can actually turn a profit within those years, but because you have so many deductions, credits, and so forth that you can take advantage of when you're filing your income tax, it may indeed appear as if your business has actually lost money when you've in fact made a profit.
Okay, that's interesting. See, that's where you get to numbers crunching that without being an accountant, I just would have no idea how to even...
Well, that's actually another excellent point that I had written down here. If you're going to start a business, get an accountant. They will save you more money than they will cost you, and they are worth their weight in gold.
And so when you're looking for an accountant, you've got to get someone who's a CPA? Because I've seen these tax people, they'll help you out with your taxes, but they're not CPAs.
Well, there's a difference between a tax accountant, a tax lawyer, and a tax preparer. Don't get mistaken. The person that you go and visit at H&R Block is probably not an accountant. They may be, but they're more specialized in helping you pull together your tax return. An accountant is there for the long run. They are there to help you think about your current expenses, how to take advantage of past ones, and how to look into the future.
And I'm sure we've got a lot of accountants here on ARFCOM, and I would really love if we have any tax accountants that are listening to the show that we have on AR15.com that are members, please get hold of me because I want to have you on one of these Going Galt segments so we can really hash out some of the legal, the real details from a real accountant to kind of help people out as we approach April 15th is coming up closer and closer now. Now, I had a friend the other day tell me a pretty sobering thing. He told me, do you realize that you go to work every day, but you really work up until basically tax day for the government? Is that right?
Let me think here. Depending on your income, you could indeed be paying anywhere from about mid-30 to 10% of your income in taxes. So I guess you could look at that as, let's say you pay 30%. Every dollar you earn, 30 cents of it goes to the government. Or every 10 months you work, 3 of it is for the government. Think of it in percentages, and not very quick with the mental math right now, but that sounds about right.
That's pretty brutal, actually. You think about one third of the year. That's 4 months out of the year. You know, basically, you're working for free. I mean, your money is going for an entitlement program to somebody who's basically not working at all.
Well, let's also keep focus on what the goal is here. Going GALT, great idea, but don't start a business just so you can take advantage of the deductions and the credits. Start a business so you can start earning income. I've worked numerous years as a government contractor, and all I can think to myself is that I'm working to make someone rich. It's not me. But if you own a business, not only are you working to make yourself rich, once you start hiring employees, they're working to make you rich. So what are you going to do? You're going to sit in the cubicle or an office your whole life until you retire, and hey, maybe you have $200,000 in a retirement account that you can use while, you know, you've been working your whole life and making people millionaires.
Well, and that's the whole point of capitalism, is that you can, at any moment, go into business for yourself.
Bingo. Entrepreneurism is what made this country rich. That hasn't changed. Just the number of people who do it have.
And that will continue. It'll be continued like that, as long as we can avoid the socialism that we have trying to be shoved down our throats right now. Now, I want to talk real quick before we have to get off here about this healthcare bill that seems to like it's going to be shoved down our throats. This was your original impetus for going GALT, wasn't it?
It was. It was several months ago, and it was at a point where I was just mentally at a stage of, this is going to happen. This is going to happen. There's nothing we can do about it. The only thing I can do is really take care of myself. And fortunately, it looks like that has not been the case. I have no idea what Queen Nancy has up her sleeve or something like that, but this was long before things like Ted Kennedy passing and Scott Brown replacing him. So
right.
Every single day that this bill, whatever number it is or whatever form it's in, every single day that passes, that this thing does not get passed, is a day that gets us closer to November.
And I watched Pelosi's press conference today. She hinted at, oh, we're reaching out to the other side of the aisle. We're going to include some language to take care of some of the lawsuits, the tort reforms type of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and that she was gonna add in some language to take care of interstate insurance across state lines. But the Republican response has still been frigid. They're going to force them to ram it through on a straight partisan line. Now, from what you know, what can we do as far as if this gets passed, as far as going GALT is in sort of a healthcare type of way?
Okay, the first thing is, how do you know a politician's lying?
Well, yeah, of course, their lips are moving.
So, going GALT from a healthcare perspective, the best things you can do are to take care of yourself. I hate to think about it, but Colorado, where I live, recently passed a candy and soda tax. So now that stuff's going to cost you more, which is kind of interesting considering that we're the leanest state in the nation. But start eating healthier, start working out. Your healthcare costs are going to go down personally. But ultimately, if there's nothing you can do about the tax end of this, you can attack it on other fronts. Business is one way, tax deductions and credits are another. But another way to think about it is to start finding people, and ARFCOM is a great resource for this. You mentioned it yourself about how we want to have any accountants who are out there come onto the Going GALT segment. Think about it. We are thousands of people that share a common interest spread all across this country. We're there to help each other out. We're there to, if we need something, you see it all the time in the equipment exchange. How much does an AR cost you if you go into a gun store? How much does that same AR cost you coming from a fellow member off of the equipment exchange?
Right.
We're
right.
here
you're
to
always,
help each other.
Yep, you're always better goods, going with an ARFCOMer.
Yeah. Secondhand goods, depending on what it is, can be just as good as firsthand. But the big difference is, one, lower price. Two, especially if it's coming off of FreeCycle or Craigslist or a social website like that, even ARFCOM, you're not paying any sales tax on it.
Taxes. Yeah, which is one of the main parts of going GALT. And I'll tell you what, Matt, we'll get into more of that next week. We've run out of time today. I really appreciate you being on for an extended period of time here with us losing some guests today. And I look forward to talking to you next week on Going Galt.
Not a problem. You caught me a little off guard, but hope I kept it entertaining. And looking forward to our next guest.
I appreciate it. And our next guest is on the line. He's the guy we've all been waiting for. He is the underground hero of ARFCOM, about to be the real hero of ARFCOM, Alan West, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening to you. How are you doing?
Good evening, and I can't thank you enough for being on the show tonight. I really can't. It's my honor. I don't know how familiar you are with our website, ar15.com.
No, I just found out about you, and it's great to have an opportunity to chat with you. So, let's share information and help me to learn more about you.
Let's do it. We are the number one gun website on the internet. We have roughly 14,000 individual different people come on every day and surf through the site. The main part of the site is a pretty big discussion board. And every time you put a video out, and I remember the first video I saw of you was here on ARFCOM, every time you put a video out, it generates some serious discussion. And most of it, 99% of it, is like, wow, where has this guy been all our lives?
Well, I've been, serving in the United States Army for 22 years. I retired down here in South Florida in 2004. I taught high school for a year and then got the call to go back and do a 2.5-year stint as civilian military advisor to the Afghan Army down in Kandahar. And, then some people thought that I had what it took to give a run at a congressional seat down here. We ran in 2008. After I got back from Afghanistan, and in an 8-month campaign, we still pulled in 45.3%, and now we're back in 2010, so we can seal the deal and we can work to get our country back on the right track.
Absolutely, and I have full faith in you this time around. I wasn't aware of your campaign in 2008, but I've gone back since and studied it, and it's amazing the amount of numbers you got with what little money you were able to raise and what little time you actually had to campaign.
Yeah, the thing about no matter what you've done in your military career, folks look at politics in a total different light, and we didn't get any support from the state or the national party, but you never tell a paratrooper what he can't do, and so we stuck to our guns, and we raised $583,000 against an incumbent who had $3.3 million, and we came within 5 points of pulling it off. So now we're back in 2010 stronger.
That's just fantastic. Let's get started on the number one issue that my listeners are interested in, and that's Second Amendment.
Yeah.
That's Second Amendment.
Oh, absolutely.
You've got the Heller case in D.C. that just went through that was for gun owners. You've got McDonald versus Chicago coming through. The current administration has been very quiet about anything gun-related, but the big fear is that they're just waiting to get some of their other pieces of the agenda down the pipe and then try to ram something through anti-Second Amendment. What are your thoughts about the Second Amendment?
Well, one of the things is very simple. I mean, it is a right to the American people to keep and bear arms. I think that what you have to realize is that if you lose your Second Amendment, your First Amendment will go away. You can look back at the mid-1930s. One of the things that Hitler did was he took away private gun ownership, and therefore you turn the people into sheeple. So I think that right now, when you look at having an armed and informed law-abiding citizenry, it is very important that they are able to protect themselves from, the tyranny of government and also the benevolence of these activist judges who are putting these criminals out on the streets. So, this is not a right that should be infringed upon. And I think that one of the things with the liberal left legislative agenda, they are very scared of the American people being able to protect themselves. They would be more than happy to have the type of situation that you see over in Iran. So, I'm an NRA member. I have a concealed weapons permit down here in the state of Florida, so you know where my heart lies.
Well, now that I know you have a concealed weapons permit, I have to ask you a question that we ask each other all the time here on AR15.com, and that is 9mm or 45?
Well, it's interesting you say that because initially I started out in the military with the 45, and then of course we went to the 9mm, And right now I'm probably leaning at going toward a 40 caliber, and I've been looking at some handguns down here, so I'll probably within the next couple of months be purchasing a 40 caliber.
Oh, okay. 40 cal. Wow. Neither 9 or 45. I have a question IM'd to me from one of our members here at AR15.com. His name is Mr. Floppy. And his question was, could you ask Alan West what he thinks about lifting the ban on machine guns?
Well, the thing with the assault weapons, once again, I think that, you know, Americans need to be looked at as responsible and accountable individuals. And I don't have any problems with Americans going out and buying those class of weapons, as long as they are, you know, operating within the right rule of law. Now, I would tell you one of the things that I do support, and it's because of a personal episode that I had with one of my young lieutenants. I think it's very important that we do have this waiting period to make sure that we do all the right background checks and what have you, because I had a lieutenant back when I was a captain, a company commander at Fort Riley, Kansas, who found out some things about his wife, was not happy about it. He immediately went down to a gun show, and back in the early 80s, late 80s, he was pretty easily able to go out, purchase a weapon right there, and then he went and shot his wife and shot himself. So that was a traumatic experience, but, you know, I don't believe it infringed upon American people.
Okay. That's a fair enough answer. One of the big problems, the issues that affects us all, is illegal immigration and the amnesty situation.
Oh, huge issue. That's a huge issue. You know, illegal immigration, let me tell you something. Illegal immigration is first and foremost is an economic issue, because, you know, we are providing financial benefits for people who are here illegally. They are violating our laws. They're violating our sovereignty as a nation. They are depressing our wages for American citizens. And there's a criminal element that's involved in it as well. And that's what makes it a national security issue. I just got finished talking to a group tonight, telling them that the number one language that's being learned by the Islamic terrorists that's come in through our southern boundary is Spanish. So we have got to do something to control our borders. You know, President Ronald Reagan back in 1986 tried this amnesty program with about 3 million. The government to this point has not secured and enforced our borders or anything similar to our laws. So we have got to get people in Washington, D.C. that will stand up and make sure that E-Verify is used. We've got to clean out our prisons. And, you know, there are only three people that should be here in this country, people that are Americans, people that want to be Americans, and tourists.
Okay, I understand completely, and I do completely agree with that. Now, that brings me to another thing, the war on drugs. But before we get to that, I want to remind everybody, your website is Alan West for Congress, AlanWestForCongress.com. If anyone, now we contributed, ARF Commerce contributed a lot of money to Scott Brown up in Massachusetts, and I want to see the same type of support for Alan West come out of you guys, ARF Commerce. You know who you are. You guys that can contribute, please contribute to this guy. He is a true conservative. He's not a rhino. He's not going to speak conservative and get to Congress and flip-flop the way other people have in the past. But let's get back to the war on drugs real quick. You've got so many people that say, you know, this thing is just a failure. It's just failed. It's done nothing but put billions of dollars into the hands of the cartels. On the other hand, you've got people that say, you know, we can't just let drugs run rampant through our communities. Where do you stand on this?
Well, I stand on the latter side. I have a buddy of mine is a DEA agent, lives right around the corner from me, and I've had the discussion with him. And, you know, I have a daughter, 16 and 13 years of age, and we can't just give up on this thing. And I think that what we have to do, and it's the exact same thing that we're doing with this war that we're against the Islamic terrorists, we've got to fully commit ourselves, and we can't go in with these half measures. We have got to track these narco terrorists and these drug lords and drug cartels, and we've got to crush them. And I think one of the key things that we have to do is with our Border Patrol. I think the Border Patrol should be brought under the Department of Defense, because this is a war that's going on down along our border. So that way we can properly arm them, properly train them, and equip them as well with the right type of resources so that they can effectively engage this enemy. You know, you're seeing this thing spill over from Juarez, Mexico. We're having American citizens now that are living in fear along the borders. So this comes back once again to one of the foundational principles and mandates of the Constitution, which says that you're supposed to provide for the common defense. And that's something that this federal government is failing on. You know, they're so much worried about, you know, health care and other things which can very easily be solved with some free market principles being adhered to. But we've got to get to the point where we're protecting American people. And I don't want to see us give up, and the next thing you know, drugs are just running rampant here on the streets. And, you know, living here in South Florida, I talked to former Broward County Sheriff Nick Navarro. He told me about the days of, you know, when it was like Scarface down here in South Florida. We don't want to return to that.
Just a reminder, you do have a lot of fans here. There's a lot of current and former law enforcement. There's a lot of current and former military people that frequent our website. One of them's name is Navy Doc One here on the site. He says, "Hello, I am an Iraqi vet, was in Charlie Medical in Ramadi," if the colonel remembers that. Do you remember that?
I think I do, yeah.
Okay. His question for you hits on the healthcare issue. He says, "What are his feelings on socialized medicine, and what proposals such as tort reform and portability would he support as alternatives to the current plan?" To the current proposal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Plan.
Yeah, absolutely. When you look at this healthcare legislation, of course, the liberal progressives are trying to push forward. It is not about health, and it's not about care. It's about creating 110 new government agencies, which means that the government will be taking over this system. And you talk about the public option. You already have four government-run programs, that is Medicaid, Medicare, the SCHIP, and the VA, and none of them are run very effectively and efficiently. If we want to do what is right for our healthcare system and reform it, which it really truthfully does need, you got to start with the tort reform. Texas and Mississippi did that. They've seen a lowering of costs, because right now doctors are charging people for exorbitant amount of procedures just to protect themselves. And Howard Dean at a town hall forum last September in Alexandria, Virginia, with Congressman Jim Moran, flat out said that they're not willing to do anything with tort reform because they don't want to take on the trial lawyer lobby. I think you also have to open up the state-by-state monopolies that the insurance companies have been able to establish, so we put Americans in charge of making them compete for what's best for us. I think you have to look at allowing small businesses to pool together so that they can have lower rates for people that go through their employers. We need to promote health savings accounts so that Americans can take care of their routine medical procedures, maybe have a little bit higher deductible, and we need to have that portability. And there is a thing out there called guaranteed renewable individual insurance, so that we get rid of this thing about pre-existing conditions and allow people to have a health plan that takes care of them regardless of what they have. And then another thing is, ties back to the legal immigration. Illegal immigrants are killing our healthcare system by using our emergency rooms at their everyday clinics. So those are the type of things I think we got to start off with. We also have to look at a lot of the fraud that is with the Medicare and the Medicaid programs. I think that you got to look at the cost of medical equipment that is out there. We got to get that under control, as well as the pharmaceutical companies.
Wow, you really are a breath of fresh air. It's just so nice to hear a politician speak the way you do. It is just completely refreshing.
Well, see, I'm not a politician. You know, the thing is, I'm an American warrior that is seeking to be an American statesman and a political leader. But I'm not going to Washington, D.C. for my own self-interest or to help promote special interests. I'm going to Washington, D.C. because we got to transfer the wealth out of that cesspool and get it back down to the everyday American, because if you want investment, ingenuity, and innovation, if you want to grow an economy, that means private sector. That means for the American citizen. That means putting money back into their pockets and not having it stored up in Washington, D.C., where the government is doing nothing right now but creating victims so that victims become dependent upon them, and then they continue to grow themselves.
Yeah, that's a deadly cycle. Oh, we've got a caller for you real quick if you've got a couple more minutes.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Scrap 5000, you're on with Alan West.
Hello, Colonel Westcott. It's a real pleasure to speak with you. And I just want to, I want to thank you from the... great, thank you. I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, both for your service to our country and for the conservative movement that, you lead and all that. If you can, though, I would like to speak to you and ask you to reconsider, though, your stance. And I'm sorry to hear about that story you told before about the lieutenant and his wife. I mean, that's a horrible thing, and obviously, you know, when you personally live through it, it may change your mind about certain things like that. But as an NRA member and as a Second Rights Amendment supporter, I would ask that you please reconsider your stance regarding the waiting period, because I think it's been proven, you know, through many studies that although it could save some lives possibly, it endangers, I think, a lot more lives than it really saves. When people, you know, you don't always need a gun, perhaps, but when you do, you need it more than anything you've ever needed before in your life, and a lot of times you just can't wait for that waiting period to save your life, to save your family's life. So I think if you could please reconsider that, I think that would be a great service as well.
Well, I will definitely take that under account, and I appreciate you at least letting me express, you know, that that event, because, you know, it fell upon me as his battery commander to identify both of those bodies that night. And, you know, I fully support people having their Second Amendment rights, but I just know that if First Lieutenant James McCoy maybe could have had a day or two to sit that and think that through, maybe could have made a difference, and two young boys could maybe still have their mother and their father.
And that's, I totally understand your point, and I appreciate you expressing that.
Oh,
hey,
thank you.
For the call,
thank you,
Frank.
Thank you.
Now, a lot of people don't know, Colonel West, that you grew up in the ghetto. You grew up in a low-income, impoverished part of Atlanta. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was, you know, middle, lower middle income, inner city Atlanta, Georgia. And the interesting thing is, it's the exact same neighborhood, you know, the fourth ward, where Dr. Martin Luther King, he was also, an alumnus of that, that community. So it was a great upbringing because even though it was an inner city neighborhood, there was strength of family back when I was growing up. And what I saw happen was the government came in, and you know, when you start to pay young girls to have children out of wedlock and to take the father out of the home, and that whole victimization takes root, young black men dropping out of high school, it destroyed my neighborhood. It's these failed liberal social welfare policies that will end up having the United States of America look like Detroit. But also, if we don't have principled people running in the Republican Party, then you see what Arnold Schwarzenegger has done with the state of California. So either way, you know, you've got to get good, committed conservative ideals and principles, because that's what my parents raised me with, and that's why I'm able to be in the position I am in today.
Okay. And I think that's great. Apparently your parents did a very, very good job with you. And I've had this conversation with a lot of my friends. I'm myself an African American, and I have had the same conversation with a lot of them about how the welfare system and the Democratic Party, the liberals, have done nothing to help us. They haven't done anything. They've done more harm than
nothing.
Good. And what can we do to get African Americans to understand that? Aside from just one-on-one conversations, it's like it's almost a blank, let's vote Democrat, because that's what we are.
Well, we got to educate them. I mean, one of the things they have to realize is that, you know, with the Republican Party, you know, that was the party of Lincoln, that was the party that fought against slavery, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, your first black congressman were Republicans, the relationship where a lot of the Republican philanthropists in this country helped to establish historical black colleges and universities, President Eisenhower, what he did in federalizing the National Guard to support the Brown versus the Board of Education desegregation decision. You know, Senator Everett Dirksen, a Republican senator, was the key factor in getting that civil rights legislation passed when people like Robert Byrd and Al Gore Sr. were against it. The Ku Klux Klan came out of the Democrat Party. Jim Crow laws came out of the Democrat Party. So we got to get that message out there. We got to educate people. And we just got to get the black community, who are the most conservative folks in America on a Sunday, to understand that there's a 21st century plantation that's being created. And when you have people like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, they're nothing but the overseers on this new plantation. And I got to tell you, the most ugly attacks against me are going to come from the members of the black community that don't want to see me get out there and be successful and get this message out, because
absolutely,
I totally invalidate everything about the liberal social welfare policies. I totally invalidate the proprietors of poverty, as I call them, Sharpton and Jackson.
Yeah, and I agree with you 100% on that. It's so inspiring to see someone like you. I can't wait for my daughter to hear this interview that I had with you. I'm just excited for this. I really want to thank you for taking some time out of your busy schedule to be with us.
As the election
draws nearer, can we please have you on again? I've got four calls right now.
I can take a couple more calls if you want.
My time runs out here in 2 minutes. I don't think we're going to have time, but can I please have you on again?
Yes, you can, and you know how to get a hold of us, and we got 8 months to go. Please visit our website, alanwestforcongress.com, and we appreciate your support in spreading our message.
Thanks for being on. One thing I want you to do is when we have people sending donations to your campaign, they're going to put ARFCOM or AR15.com on their donation. I want you to take note of how much money you get from us, okay?
Absolutely. We'll be tracking it.
Thanks a lot, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. He's running for Congress, Florida District 22. If you live in Florida and you're in that district, register to vote and vote for this guy. He is on our side 100%. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Merrill, as usual, for keeping the threads up to date with all the links. I want to thank our guests, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, John Ross, Matt Hoffman, for being on today. Joe DeBurgolese, as always, he'll be on next week. Old Painless was on as well. We had a great show. We had some rough times in the first hour. I apologize to everyone for that. But next week, I promise, it'll go a lot smoother. Everybody hang in there, and God bless America.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.